You and I back together again, wrapping up the month of September, Thursday, September 30th, 2021, on Connecticut Today. University of New Haven criminal justice professor Mike Lawler on the latest FBI crime numbers. We talked about those in the 3 o'clock hour. With the start of legal sports gambling in Connecticut, addiction expert Dr. Lyndon Aguiar joined us to talk about what folks may have to deal with problem gambling going forward now that sports is part of the mix. And I also had some thoughts on what former 5th District Democratic Congresswoman Elizabeth Esty told the Washington Post about the current lack of bipartisanship in Congress, and she was right on the money. Here, we'll be back to open phones a little bit later on in the show. When we do that, we'll be at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Let's talk some criminal justice here. You've probably seen it. You heard it here. We talked about it on the show. It's been in all the papers, on all the TV outlets as well. The latest FBI uniform crime report was published a few days ago. Nationwide numbers, state numbers. What does all this mean? We welcome once again Mike Lawler, currently a professor of criminal justice at the University of New Haven, longtime East Haven Democratic state rep, and did a lot with criminal justice and corrections while he was under Governor Dan Malloy. Mike, Paul here. How are you, sir? All right.
Hey, Paul. How are you?
I'm all right. Great here. I'm all right. Good for you. Well, you faculty guys, you got the nice lounges. You got the nice office. It's, you know, it's always good. It's always good.
Living Mike, the life.
Yeah. What? Yeah. All right, Mike. The uniform crime report. Before we get into it, where does this come from? People see it and they say FBI uniform crime report. How was this put together, Mike?
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, this has come out every year since 1960, and it gives you the national numbers and it also gives you the state by state numbers. And the FBI get these numbers from state agencies, in our case, from the Connecticut State Police, and the Connecticut State Police, in turn, get their numbers from local police. Every department is obligated to report these numbers at the end of the year. These are numbers about reported crime, not arrests. I mean, they keep track of arrests as well, but this is whether someone's arrested or not, whether no matter how old they might be, it's a reported crime. And the ones that they track are called index crimes. And the easiest way to think of this are crimes with victims. So like murder, assault, sexual assault, burglary, robbery, auto theft. Those are the main ones that are tracked.
So basically throwing a brick through a window or graffiti or smashing up a basketball court, that's not, that's a property crime or vandalism. That's not recorded. I just want to make sure I know what's going on here.
That's not reported like that by the FBI. However, when the state police also issue an annual report, and you can see it for every town, that'll come out hopefully in the next month or so for last year. And there you'll see all that kind of stuff. You'll see drug arrests, mm-hmm. You'll see prostitution arrests, vandalism, all that stuff.
All right. So obviously in your previous line of work, in your current line of work, you probably pore over these numbers. What are your thoughts on what you've seen both nationally and locally?
Well, there's some good news and there's some bad news, right? The good news part is, in general, overall crime is down nationwide and here in Connecticut. However, within those numbers, there's some troubling numbers. For example, murders and homicides are up in Connecticut quite a bit, like 30%. Nationally, they're up a little over 27%. And the other thing that's up is auto thefts in Connecticut and nationwide. So those are two things that stick out. Pretty much everything else is trending downward. Connecticut actually defied the violent crime trend because overall, nationally, violent crime, all forms of violent crime together were up about 6%. In Connecticut, they were down 2% in 2020. So that was that's good. Murders were up, but the other form, you know, robbery, assault, sexual assault are also violent crimes.
Mike Lawler is a guest. Mike, hang on. I want to get into a little bit more of the murder problem when we come back. University of New Haven College professor Mike Lawler is the guest, longtime East Haven Democratic state rep and a criminal justice specialist under former Governor Dan Malloy. We'll get into more of these numbers straight ahead first, though. Traffic and weather together at 3:36 on WICC. And yes, besides the weather and sports, a lot of people, no matter where they live, Westport, Bridgeport, New Haven, Haven, Bethany, Hartford, Fairfield. A lot of folks talk about crime because inevitably and invariably it's touched them or someone they know. Mike Lawler is with us for a few more minutes, criminal justice professor at the Henry C. Lee School at the University of New Haven. Mike, I don't envy Mike, the local police departments in urban areas like Hartford, like Bridgeport, like Waterbury, New London, New Haven, who have to deal, Mike, with these ebbs and flows in urban violence and murders like you were talking about. And man, I know there's only so much they can do, but correct me if I'm wrong. The idea that these murders happen, Mike, in these gang settings and urban settings, a lot of this is a mindset, right? I mean, you've got to have, we always hear about it, there's a beef or a grudge. And how do you make that not happen, Mike? I don't get it. I don't understand it.
Well, as you point out, a lot of it, it involves shooting at different people, shooting at other people for reasons that you and I would consider like really stupid.
Yeah.
Right. And a lot of this has to do with beefs, as you point out, groups and gangs battling with each other, revenge shootings, because this guy got shot, so his gang is now coming after the other guy. You know, it's that type of stuff. And, most of it is happening in Hartford, Bridgeport, and New Haven, lesser extent in some of the smaller cities. And it's a relatively small number of people responsible for a relatively large percentage of these types of shootings. So that's true. Before the pandemic hit, police departments in Connecticut and around the country had gotten really good at preventing these kinds of shootings by doing this face-to-face interventions with the guys most likely to either get shot or shoot somebody. Plus, you know, clergy, local political leaders, community leaders in those neighborhoods. And these prevention tactics were very effective. It all ground to a halt as soon as the pandemic hit, because there could be no more face-to-face stuff. That is just starting up again now. So hopefully the numbers have come down. The other factor, also related to the pandemic, is that the courts were closed for almost a year. And so if you arrested one of these guys, if they were able to post bond, they're out, right? And so you weren't able to deal with cases in court, and I think that's a factor as well. So that's much better now than it was a year ago, for sure. Courts are starting to get back up and running, and so put those two things together and a few other factors, you know, kind of explains what happened.
And I would think, Mike, that enough of these, it's generally young men. You and I both know this. I mean, there's some girls affected, but it's generally young men. I would imagine, Mike, if they're told enough times, hey, listen, think before you do this, breathe, walk away. I know it doesn't look macho, but you may end up making your life worth something and not having to spend 20 or 30 years or whatever in jail. I would imagine that has to work, Mike, to a point.
That's not my sense, actually. I've talked to a lot of these guys, and I've been to a lot of these call-ins where they bring in and they do these confrontations with the guys. And, you know, for a lot of these kids, and when you say young, we're talking about like basically under 30, really.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of these people aren't counting on being alive in a year.
Wow.
I mean, it's sad, but there's a lot of that. And almost all these guys have, you know, never really had a first chance. Not in any way minimizing what they're doing, but I mean, there's some messed up lives out there, and trying to find ways to give them some kind of an opportunity to shift gears and go in the right direction is important. But, it's not always going to be successful. I mean, the good news is there's a relatively small number of people. The bad news is it's hard to figure out how to get them off that track.
I noticed, Mike, too, some of the urban centers, Bridgeport, Hartford, and New Haven, as you concentrate on, are trying more technological things. And people may have seen the story, Mike, of the chief and the mayor in New Haven, Justin Elliker, now trying to allocate more money for things as simple as more video cameras. I know several cities use the ShotSpotter technology. That stuff good? Has it had an effect on this whole thing, Mike?
Yeah. Oh, it's a big impact. And I'm on the New Haven Board of Police Commissioners. So, you know, I'm a big fan of New Haven. I think it's a welcome addition. Hartford has an extraordinary camera capability. I mean, they've demonstrated, I mean, these things are on the top of telephone poles. They can zoom in and read a driver's license in someone's hand while they're sitting in a car. I mean, that's how good these cameras are. And so when the ShotSpotter goes off, they can immediately key in the cameras and they can basically see what's going on. And it's very, very helpful, And it's also helpful for prevention. It's not just catching people after the shooting. You know, the main goal is to not have it happen in the first place. So technology, it's definitely scary for some people, but it's very effective. And, in this day and age, there's no excuse not to employ it. And certainly there's a need for it.
All right, Mike, final question. You're not in the General Assembly, of course, anymore. But if you were talking to members of the General Assembly now and the leadership on both sides, which I know you still do from time to time, when they get to a longer session again, a lawmaking session, not the short session coming up, but what would you tell them and say, hey, here's the next thing in criminal justice that should be done in this state? What would that be? What would you say?
Well, it's more of a, I mean, I think you really have to invest in good law enforcement. And when I say good law enforcement, it doesn't simply mean more cops. Mm-hmm. It means making sure that the police we have are properly trained, properly equipped, and properly motivated to ultimately prevent crime. And what we've seen is where that's a priority, the places where that's a priority, they can really bring the crime numbers down. And the good news is that's going on, right? I see it firsthand all the time in the roles I play. You know, I'm also, the governor appointed me to be a member of the Police Officer Standards and Training Council. We do the curriculum mm-hmm. for the academy. You know, so I get a good sense of how things are changing. So making sure there's proper, training costs money. You got to pay the officers to participate in it. You got to pay the instructors and you've got to equip them and you have to recruit them. And it's a challenge, but I think that as much as anything will help, because there are strategies that do work. And once we get beyond the pandemic, keep in mind that 2018, we had the fewest murders in Connecticut that we've had in over 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
So we're spiking up from a really low number, and I hope we can get back to that as soon as possible.
Speaking of local cops, one more thing, Mike. You hear about cops leaving town A to go to town B or to go to the state police or whatever municipality. Is there too much of a difference in what municipalities pay to keep cops there for a long time, or does that just come with the territory?
There's definitely some big differences, right? And not just in salary, but also in benefits. You know, 30 years ago, almost every town had a 20 years and out retirement plus, a fixed benefit retirement deal plus health insurance. And you see that shift over to like 401k type, you're not going to get pension, but what you're going to get is money put aside for you. And health insurance is a big thing. So I think you're seeing towns trying to take the cheap way out and in the process losing officers to other towns. So that has a lot to do with. Plus, some cops like to work in big cities because there's more action and more of a challenge.
Yeah.
Others would like to go from a big city to a small town so they can not do a whole lot. So, I think it's like any other job, right? So. But you can't blame people for looking for the best possible deal.
No, absolutely not. University of New Haven criminal justice professor Mike Lawler has joined us. Mike, thank you. Be good. We'll talk down the road. Appreciate it.
Anytime, Paul.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Mike Lawler, former state rep East Haven, still active in criminal justice. You heard that. He's active in New Haven on the state level. Did a lot under former Governor Daniel Malloy as well. Well, like the man said, Bridgeport, the Valley, Fairfield County, all those areas and more will soon have access remotely on your phone or on your computer, your desktop, your laptop, your tablet to online casino gaming and sports gambling. Pretty soon, the sports gambling part of it got underway earlier today. Governor Ned Lamont throwing down a few dollars on the WNBA's Connecticut Sun in their current WNBA playoff series. But a lot of people have concerns about this and are wondering about, addictions. Is this not going to be good for people who struggle already with sports gambling? Could it create new sports gambling addicts? Joining us to talk about that right now is Dr. Lyndon Aguiar. Dr. Aguiar is clinical director at Summit Hill Wellness and Williamsville Wellness. Check them out online at summithillwellness.com. Dr. Aguiar, good afternoon. Paul here in Connecticut. How are you?
Pretty good. Thank you so much for taking time to talk about this important topic.
And can you tell us a little bit before we get into that, Doctor, about Summit Hill Wellness and what folks can find if they go to summithillwellness.com?
Yes, Summit Hill Wellness is our outpatient division of Williamsville Wellness, and we've been addressing gambling disorder and gambling addiction since 2007. And we were really fulfilling a need where there was a lot of people with compulsive pathological gambling. It was destroying their life, and it was out of control. So we started with development with residential treatment with them. And then our Summit Hill Wellness Office provides outpatient treatment to them that's made available online as well. So we're working with people from both the residential level who need very, very intensive treatment to deal with gambling that's destroying their lives. It's leading to severe mental health concerns, depression, suicidal thoughts, to a lower level of treatment that would also address the gambling issues that are causing lots of problems in their relationships and their functioning.
So, Dr. Aguiar, let me tell you, obviously this has been going on now in other states for a while. Connecticut comes on today. So you tell me, what are your concerns here, Dr. Aguiar, to our listeners? What should they watch out for? What are your big concerns from a mental health and an addiction services point of view?
Yeah, specifically with gambling related to sports betting. Sports betting could often be more addictive than, say, traditional gambling at the casino. That involves more time and involvement to go to the casino and gamble. But with online sports betting, it's normalized in a lot of respects, and it's very fast-paced. So within a game, for example, you could be making multiple wagers while the game is on about scores, performance, players, and even these bets could be small, but in a short amount of time, some of these thousands of dollars in minutes. And it's what's happening from a mental health standpoint, dopamine and other stuff is being activated in the brain. It's very similar to cocaine addiction in a lot of respects. And it's once that person is looking for that fix, you know, the gambling, sports betting particularly, is another way to do that. And it's more hidden. It's more insidious because you can't do a drug test and find out they're gambling. You have to look at their bank account. But it's more hidden. It's more normalized. And when someone does want help, people are like, yeah, just stop gambling. They don't realize it's very much like alcohol, substance use, in terms of its effects on the brain.
Dr. Lyndon Aguiar is the guest. Doctor, hang on. We'll be right back to you. I want to get a little deeper into this. Once again, our guest is Dr. Lyndon Aguiar. He's clinical director at Summit Hill Wellness and Williamsville Wellness. We're talking about the dangers of compulsive sports gambling. And again, not everybody's going to be compulsive here, but we'll see what those numbers do if Connecticut goes online today. First, though, traffic and weather together at 4:36 on WICC. Well, some of the folks in Shelton in a couple of weeks after the soft launch today may be logging on from their home computer, their desktop, their laptop, their tablet, their phones to bet sports online. Dr. Lyndon Aguiar is the guest today. We brought him on because today was the soft launch of sports gambling in the state of Connecticut. Dr. Aguiar, is sports gambling tougher to deal with? You tell me, rather than the person who may be hooked, say, to the lottery because, okay, give me 10 or 15 quick pick tickets versus somebody who may say, hey, I like sports because I can figure it out. I've got the odds. Yeah, I know how this team plays. This pitcher stinks. I'm going to bet against him. Is that an added problem that you clinicians have in dealing with this?
It absolutely is. The type of gambling that sports betting is called action gambling, where there's actually skill involved. There's a potential for someone to have some knowledge and information that in their mind gives them a competitive advantage over somebody else, whereas lottery and more games of chance, slot machines, keno, things like that are more purely random. We call that escape gambling. So that escape gambling, a little different process in the brain. But someone who's action gambling is, in a lot of respects, looking for that stimulation and that excitement, and they can share that information. It fills a need, and because it's so getting normalized, people can talk about it anywhere, especially when a team that's a local team doing well. So there's a lot of analytics involved, and there's statistics. And so if you're highly intelligent, I think you're more prone to sports betting being a disorder, a gambling disorder, because it's really trying to fulfill that need for that stimulation. So yes, I do think it's more insidious. I think it's more dangerous, but it works in a different way. I mean, for sure, gambling related to lottery and escape gambling also is very detrimental, but both have devastating effects.
I am old enough to remember, Dr. Aguiar, when the local newspapers, not just here in Connecticut, but all around the country, were chastised when they put point spreads in, the Vegas odds, even though gambling was not legal in most other states until Jersey and a few others. And now we've gone to network football and baseball and hockey broadcasts on television, where they're doing this. They have touts on. They look at experts to talk about this whole thing, and that's got to drive you crazy in trying to treat some folks here, because the media doctor, are they not saying, hey, this is okay, this is not in the shadows anymore?
Absolutely, and there's just with the information age in general, so much information is available, so many channels are available to watch in-depth analysis on sports. So you can, if you wanted to go and get the information that's out there, there's that feeling of this is again fulfilling a need. So I do think TV ads, you see a lot of these different these sports betting websites. I'm not going to name them, but they make it look like everybody wins. Everyone is the winner. Almost you can't lose, and kind of join in on the party. That's the message you hear, and people will think, okay, it's harmless, let me try this. And depending on really the biological and genetic and the environmental factors, it's just like using cocaine. It's very similar.
So from a clinical point of view, how is addictive sports gambling or the addiction treated? Are there similarities into how you folks at your outfit and others around the country treat, say, cocaine or sex or drug addiction? And are there similarities? And what are the differences as well?
Yeah, there are quite a few similarities. The person with gambling addiction can go to Gambling Anonymous, Gamblers Anonymous, GA, just like they can go to AA or NA, Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous. But on top of that, that's not treatment. That's more support that's available to get back on track with recovery. But treatment-wise, from starting from regular outpatient therapy with someone who's skilled to deal with addiction to intensive outpatient programming, is where you go several times a week for several weeks, but you're still staying at home and you're doing this but multiple times a week, to residential treatment, which is the highest level of care that we do, where you're going away for about 3 weeks, 3 to 4 weeks, and you're completely away from the addictive elements, as well as immersing in treatment for multiple therapy sessions a day. So that would be the same similar approach with alcohol and substance use. One of the biggest differences with the treatment is there's a need for financial accountability. So we would actually help the patient work out a plan to manage their finances and set barriers. We would look at their support system. I mean, that's also in other types of addiction. But what are things they're doing to limit access to money and find ways to address that? So with medication-wise, we would also be looking at medications that would help with impulse control, with some of the underlying issues with addiction. We often see depression, anxiety, unresolved trauma, loss. I mean, you just name it, just piles up, and the addiction is basically a maladaptive way of escaping from all that. So we're trying to give them obviously better tools to address the helplessness that drives the addiction. So yeah, the similarities are very much similar to substance alcohol treatment, but then the differences would be the financial piece, how we help them track that and monitor that, and then providing proper stimulation through the other kinds of outlets they might develop maybe they have to look at changing their work environments or social environments. If a lot of their contacts are on their fantasy football team, then they may need to really make some changes.
Yeah.
So it is complex.
Finally, Dr. Aguiar, the state here in Connecticut, and I know other states may do this, they've set up an opt-out system where people can willingly put their information in, tell the state, hey, I have to be barred from this. And I think here in Connecticut, you could do it for a year, 5 years, or a lifetime. Are those opt-out systems worth it? Do you find they work or not?
They are certainly helpful, and that's something we would, if it's available in the state, we would encourage that, just like we would encourage someone who's going to the casino to opt out of the casino. There's ways to self-exclude. But that's a good start, and we would encourage people to utilize that. But there's plenty of systems in place where a person may still have access to it, but when they win, then they're not allocated winnings.
Oh.
So they can still get involved. I have to do some more research on Connecticut's opt-out system, but it doesn't prevent other types of gambling that could still take place, but it certainly is helpful. So I would encourage people to utilize that whenever possible, and that'd be just one of many things you can use. So I would encourage that.
The website is summithillwellness.com, summithillwellness.com. Dr. Lyndon Aguiar is clinical director at Summit Hill Wellness and Williamsville Wellness. Doctor, thank you. We appreciate it. It's been a crazy day here, and we thank you for the time. Appreciate it. Thank you.
I really appreciate your time you've given to this important topic and your time today. So thank you as well.
Thank you, Dr. Lyndon Aguiar there. So and several companies offer treatment across the spectrum here. The inpatient is Williamsville Wellness. The web-based aftercare is Summit Hill Wellness. So there you go. There's something I wanted to talk about today because I noticed a story that involves a former Connecticut member of Congress, former Congresswoman Elizabeth Esty, who did not run for re-election a couple of terms ago. Now, the former Congresswoman had some problems in her office with harassment and how she dealt with it and all that. But that's been well documented. However, Congresswoman Esty was the Democrat in this article from the Washington Post, who also spoke with Charlie Dent, a former Republican congressman, and the senior congressional correspondent at the Washington Post, Paul Kane. Now, and this ended up in one of my news feeds, and I saw it on Tom Dudchick's site, the Capitol Report, and geez, I said, what's Elizabeth Esty talking about? You know, former member of Congress, is there something of note here? And basically, Paul Kane and Charlie Dent and Elizabeth Esty were asked, what's wrong with Congress? Can't people in Congress get along anymore? And it was kind of fortuitous to run this today because we're in the middle of this cha-cha going on in D.C. They're trying to avoid a government shutdown, which isn't really a government shutdown. 75% of everything still runs, but some of the extraneous stuff would get put on hold. Don't have any fear. You're still going to get your Social Security check, your benefit checks, whatever. Calm down on that. But you see some of the childishness in Congress right now, and it's on both sides. Look, I'm not going to sit here and say it's only Democrats, because it is some Republicans, too. And both sides have their share of members of Congress that, and I'm sorry if you think this is ageism, if you think this is sexism, if you think this is something I shouldn't be saying, I don't care. But you have new representatives, when they get to Congress, they think suddenly everybody should listen to them. And for the vast majority of them, you know what I would tell them if I was in D.C.? Honestly, if I was leadership on either side, sit down and shut up. Sit your ass down over there and shut up before you start dictating to us. Yes, seniority, whether people like it or not, it has a place in society. It's like in this radio business I'm in. When we first got in the radio business, almost everybody in this business can tell you, our first full-time gig, God, we were so happy and so excited. We wouldn't dare think of telling our bosses at the station or the news department, you know, when we're in the building for 10 minutes, hey, here's what you should do. And look, I understand that technically a freshman member of Congress, a first term member of Congress and somebody in their 10th term, well, they're both in Congress. Yeah, but there is a seniority thing. And let me take this all back to something Elizabeth Estey said. The Washington Post person said, what's wrong with Congress? One of the questions they asked Elizabeth Estey and also the congressional correspondent and the other gentleman, Charlie Dent of Pennsylvania. Now, of course, when people are not in Congress anymore, guess what? Oh, permission to speak freely, sir. Yes, permission granted. And basically, Elizabeth Estey said something really interesting. And yeah, okay, I'm not saying it because she agrees with me on it, because almost most people don't. But, however, she was asked by this person at the Washington Post, you know, what's the problem here? Here's Elizabeth Estey's answer. Listen to this. What's the problem here? Quote, the rise of social media. It's a technology that has crafted enormous incentives to be intransigent, outraged, and outrageous. Social media is wildly disruptive, and it has been no place more disruptive than in the political realm. She continued, you get likes, you get attention, you get on TV, you get money, you get power by not playing ball, by going straight to social media. You can have a brand new member of Congress. You can be Marjorie Taylor Greene. You can be Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And everybody knows their names, and they raise a ton of money, and they get on TV and are talked about all the time. And the people who play by the rules, do their work in committee, get amendments done here and there, they get none of that. End quote. Thank you, Congresswoman Estey, for saying what needed to be said. Thank you. And I don't want to hear you call me and say, oh, you're agreeing with a Democrat? Yes, I am. Yes, I am. Wholeheartedly on this one. People like AOC on the Democratic side and Marjorie Taylor Greene, until they get their chops, until they actually know what they're talking about and are not concerned with just sending out social media tweets, you know what? They should shut up. Shut up. That display of Marjorie Taylor Greene screaming the other day and getting into a shouting match on the steps of the Capitol with Congresswoman Debbie Dingell, who you may agree with her or you may not agree with her. That's not the point. That display was horrendous the other day. Have a little courtesy. Act like an adult, will you? And on the other side, AOC, I have an idea. Take your tax the rich dress and, yeah. But, man, Congresswoman Estey or former Representative Estey, whatever you'd prefer, man, she is so spot on this. People get to Congress and they start to tweet and they start to say this and that. No, you're there to discuss policy with people who actually know what they're talking about. Not, and I'm sorry I have to say this, but folks, it's the truth. And at this stage of my life, I don't care. You stop sending out tweets to the great unwashed, will you please? Stop trying to discuss budget policy and the intricacies of a federal budget with people who couldn't find Washington on a map. I'm begging you. Social media, folks, I'm telling you over and over and over again, you have a section of Congress, the younger members of Congress, who use social media as a battering ram and a crutch because they have no concept of issues and they have no gravitas. Nobody respects them. How about building some respect and lay off the Twitter for a while? What do you think? But again, kudos to Elizabeth Estey, the former 5th District Congressman, saying, you know, basically it's social media. It's younger members of Congress, the AOCs, the Marjorie Taylor Greens of the world, who get elected. And frankly, too, another thing. Well, the people elected me. Yeah, and sometimes you're from districts that will elect a dog to Congress if they have a D or an R next to their name. And I'm sorry. Look, do I have my problems with politicians? Yeah, I do. What do we talk about here a lot on the show? But I prefer to talk and discuss things about people who are sincere about their beliefs and actually know what they're talking about. And you know what? And I say it to my liberal friends all the time about AOC. AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Now, granted, she got elected. I get it. I understand it. She's from a very safe Democratic district in New York with a low voter turnout. Okay, she doesn't make the rules. She played by the rules. Right? She got elected. And the same thing with Marjorie Taylor Greene from Georgia, I believe. She got elected. But I don't think that any of these people have any influence whatsoever. They're carnival barkers. They're rodeo clowns. They're carnival barkers. I mean, AOC, for somebody who's in Congress, how dumb can she be going to the Met Gala the other day? And she wears this tax the rich dress. Okay, whatever. Got her PR. Remember, she's looking for PR. She's looking for clicks, right? And then it turns out 2 days later, you know, some intrepid, you know, a random act of journalism was committed. And somebody at the New York Post or somebody ran the name, or maybe Republican Research put it out there. They ran the name of AOC's dress designer. The woman that was with her the night of the Met Gala, sitting there smiling next to her tax the rich dress. And guess what? Her dress designer owes a lot of money in back taxes. Now, how stupid can you be? Honestly. But again, if you're dealing on either side, you know, let's not, this ain't all the Democrats. But Democrat or Republican, when you're dealing with low information voters, with people who don't look at things critically, and all they vote for is the uniform, whether there's a D or an R on the uniform. If that's the only thing to get you elected, then you can essentially get away with all the more garbage. And if it sounds like I'm cranky today about this, yes, I am. I mean, look at what's going on in D.C. with this infrastructure bill. This infrastructure bill should have been voted on months ago. Months ago. But because Nancy Pelosi can't control her kindergarten caucus there of, again, the progressives on the left, and they're trying to hold the infrastructure bill hostage for a bigger spending, but why don't you just pass the damn infrastructure bill? They act like children. They act like a kindergarten class of children, and it's not good.